Over NBC's coast-to-coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Now, to introduce the discussion of cancer research today, we present Dr. Charles B. Huggins, Chairman of the Committee on Cancer of the University of Chicago. Dr. Huggins.
What is the cancer problem? It is scarcely necessary to state it again. From the standpoint of brass tacks, it is an anticipated mortality of 200,000 deaths in the United States this year. It is an expected cost of hundreds of millions in the expenses of hospitalization in 1949. It is the difficult and lonesome road of chronic disease, on which man slowly trudges his painful path alone, his end being certain and his time of passage indefinite, but rather brief. Of all diseases, cancer is the most dreadful and the most feared. But now we have the courage to talk about it in public, perhaps because statistics indicate that 2/3 of the patients in whom cancer is discovered in 1949 will be cured by treatment. Through constantly reiterated warnings, the public is now well aware that the occurrence of lumps, or unusual bleeding anywhere, or persistent sores may indicate cancer. These complaints certainly call for a prompt consultation with a physician, as well as discerning an intelligent and vigorous action by the medical advisor. All this is not enough. The cancer problem, in its most urgent facet, concerns the other third, in whom the lack of symptoms or neglect, in one way or another, prevent important action to wipe out the disease. Over preceding roundtables, we have discussed cancer from several viewpoints. We have talked about the symptoms of cancer and some of the great contributions that the laboratories have made to the welfare of the patient who is ill with this disease. At this time, we shall discuss the strategy of cancer research rather than the tactics, the forest rather than the bushes. Happily, we start this discussion in complete agreement that research is the most important aspect of cancer activities. To discuss cancer research today on the University of Chicago Roundtable are Dr. Milton C. Winternitz, the chief builder of the Yale Medical School, director of the Childs Fund, and chairman of the Committee on Growth of the National Research Council. We have also Surgeon General Leonard A. Sheely of the United States Public Health Service, and Mr. Ben May, a successful lumberman of Mobile, who also happens to be a great patron of cancer research. Dr. Winternitz, how has the great organized private effort to support cancer research developed?
Dr. Huggins, until the end of the First World War, available resource for medical research was very small indeed. With few exceptions, it was a byproduct of teaching personnel of a few of the schools of medicine. For cancer, it was a negligible sum, less than a penny per person for the people of the United States. When the Anna Fuller Fund was established in 1932, the medical director experienced difficulty in interesting any member of the staff of a large and reputable medical institution sufficiently to accept funds for cancer research. But dollars are prone to excite interest. And with the later advent of the Donner Fund, the Jane Coffin Childs Fund, and the National Cancer Institute, corresponding growth of the small nucleus of investigators developed with cause and control of cancer as their prime objective. The American Cancer Society, with its splendid record of service since 1913, gave large impetus to cancer study with its greatly expanded nationwide program in 1945. With the well-earned confidence of the public and its vast organization, the annual drives have been increasingly successful. It is fully anticipated that the fourth American Cancer Society drive, now in progress this month of April, will yield the desired amount, $14,500,000. Approximately $2 million, contributed by American people, many of them included in our listeners, has been spent by this society for fundamental research in each of the past several years.
Surgeon General Sheely, what is the government doing to support cancer research?
Dr. Huggins, the United States Public Health Service, which I head, is the principal civilian public health agency of the federal government. As long ago as 1920, one of our men recognized the need for more cancer research and began a small research program in borrowed laboratories on the campus of Harvard University in Boston. The next major event in the government program occurred in 1937 when Congress decided that militant action to expand cancer research was needed. Representatives of an enlightened citizenry, appeared before committees of Congress and demanded this. Congress then passed and the president signed the now famous National Cancer Institute Act. Unique features of this act were expansion of research by our workers in a new Cancer Institute building in Bethesda, Maryland, a suburb of Washington, D.C. Equally important, authority was given in law to grant funds to universities and to laboratories and to individuals outside government to assist in financing their cancer research. Provision was also made to give research fellowships to worthy young men and women in order to increase the number of research workers. Recently, Congress has authorized us to build expanded cancer research facilities. When the new building is completed, we will bring laboratory research and the study of the cancer patient side by side. Another marvelous thing about our expanded cancer research program at the Cancer Institute is that it will be intimately related to all of our medical research programs, including our new research program on heart diseases. Dr. Huggins, I know that it will be of great interest to you to learn that the amount available through the National Cancer Institute for outside research for the year 1938 was barely $150,000. This amount remained the same each year until 1946, when it went up to $500,000. Gradually, in the last 3 years, this amount has increased to $3 million. It should be mentioned, too, that the Atomic Energy Commission has an additional $5 million to support cancer research this year. Thus, barely 5 cents of federal tax funds for each person in our nation are being spent to assist research workers study cancer in university and other private laboratories.
Dr. Shealy, it certainly does interest me. Mr. May, how does this perspective of cancer research appeal to you as a successful businessman?
Dr. Huggins, I'm not satisfied with the program of cancer research. There is not enough. As a country, we spend over $1 billion a year for soda water and chewing gum, $2 billion yearly for beauty shops and cosmetics, and $3 billion a year for tobacco products. We spend hundreds of billions for war. Single corporations spend as much as $30 million in a year for research, which sum is more than is now spent on cancer research. And to my surprise, I have noted that this nation spends more than $5 million yearly for goldfish, and it has spent more than $50 million in a year for toy electric trains. That is a very great deal more than this country has ever spent in any year for cancer research. The question then is not, can we afford as great a program as now outlined, but to me, it is rather, can we afford not to regard that program as a minimum step in the effort to conquer cancer? All of us have a stake in the progress of medicine, although many who are well are incapable of realizing that they can possibly fall ill. Consequently, the people most vitally alive to the importance of more progress in medicine are generally sick and often dying. However, no matter how desperately they may crave progress in medicine, when in pain, their physical condition makes them unable to give impetus to the movement. They become most passionately interested at the moment when they are least capable of doing anything about it.
Despite inadequate funds and public support of cancer research until recently, the laboratories have not been inactive, but they have made satisfactory progress in a number of areas in the cancer field. A good example of the developments of the laboratory concerns our present understanding of the ways and wiles of cancer of the breast, one of the commonest cancers of the human female. Dr. Tizer at Harvard in 1906 discovered that in mice, cancer of the breast tended to run in families. At that time, all of the students of heredity were under the influence of Mendel, who had shown in a beautiful fashion that in sweet peas, heredity was transmitted by a constituent of the cell called chromosomes. In 1934, the Jackson Laboratory at Bar Harbor showed that the high incidence of cancer of the breast in certain families was transmitted much more through the mother than through the father. And Dr. John Bittner at that laboratory showed further a very important thing, that there were other influences beside the chromosomes at work, namely agents in the mother's milk and tissue fluids, thus demonstrating the hereditary characteristics of components outside of the nucleus of the cell. At about the same time, it was shown in Paris that the hormones of the female were a great causative factor in cancer of the breast. By giving these hormones of femaleness to otherwise susceptible mice, one could produce breast cancer at will. Since 1944, many of these facts of the laboratory of pure science
have been applied to women with cancer of the breast, and some very worthwhile measures of control in selected cases of advanced disease of the breast in females have been developed, especially through the use of hormones, a contribution of the laboratory in cancer research to the welfare of sick people. Dr. Windernitz, would you speak further about the great inclusive sweep of the cancer research front?
Dr. Huggins, growth may well be said to be a most complicated problem. Why does it start? Why does it stop? What determines the orderly balance between these two ultimate controls? When this balance is lost, cancer, in its many forms, is a major result. The idea of cancer as a crab-like parasite prevailed until the advent of the microscope. Then it was readily demonstrated that cancers, like tissues and organs generally, are composed of cells, and that these cells individually, and also in the pattern of their arrangement, simulate those of the site of their origin. Variation in cell size and in nuclear detail has been found to be valuable in estimating both the rate of growth of the tumor and the effects on the host. Developments arising out of modern physics and chemistry bid fair to provide increasing knowledge of the content of the various structures of the cell, the speed of their turnover, and the differences between normal and cancer cells in these respects. Progress can be anticipated between content of cells of animal species that develop cancer in high and low percentages spontaneously or by the application of known cancer agents. The radioactive group and compounds from many different sources, including coal tar, hormones like those of the ovary, and also viruses. The latter have long been known to be causatively related to cancer in the chicken and have since been similarly related in other species. They are of prime interest in another association of major consideration. The inheritance of mouse cancer is known to be dependent upon the milk the young receive from the mother. The agent in the milk is now considered to be a virus. These viruses are composed of compounds that are also found in the nuclei of cells. When it is remembered that viruses live and multiply only within the cell, many possibilities of relationship of virus and cell nucleus suggest themselves in relation to growth. Detailed knowledge of chemistry is sorely needed for the illumination of growth and cancer. Chemists are required in many special fields. Not only platoons and battalions, but regiments and indeed armies of them. Physicists must apply many of the tools and illuminate, perhaps, interpretations. The present would seem to be the era of the chemist, working in close harmony with biologists for the disclosure of basic knowledge. With this, and with all the many essential safeguards, the physician versed in the clinical approach to investigation must carry on. The objective is the elimination of cancer in man. The chemist and biologist can only supply the tools. The qualified physician is essential for the attack where man is involved, and so another great requirement is the development of this investigating type of clinician in sufficient numbers and the provision of the facilities essential for his work.
Dr. Shealy, we all know of many important developments at the National Cancer Institute, which is an important branch of the United States Public Health Service. What developments in the NCI recently appeal to you?
Dr. Huggins, I would like to mention the work of one of the Institute scientists, Dr. Wilton Earle, who has been growing living cells taken from animals in test tubes. He found that exposure of one of these normal cells to the stimulus of a cancer-producing chemical made the normal cell become malignant. This finding is of special importance to cancer research workers because the living cell in the test tube was free from potential interaction with the organs and other parts of the whole body. Thus, it was shown that this added chemical alone had caused cancer.
Dr. Windernitz, we mentioned earlier that you were chairman of the Committee on Growth. What is the Committee on Growth? How does it function? And how are decisions made on the spending of contributions to the American Cancer Society, so as to best advance cancer research. I am sure our listeners would like to hear a report on how their money is spent.
Dr. Huggins, in 1945, the American Cancer Society's request to the National Research Council for advice on the allocation of money for cancer research was met by Dr. Lewis H. Weed, chairman of the Medical Science Division, by the organization of the Committee on Growth. A body of 22 distinguished investigators representing the majority of the fundamental sciences. With the dynamic and capable aid of Dr. C.P. Rhodes, chairman of the committee during the initial 3 years of its life, a system was evolved that subjected the requests for research projects to the scrutiny of one of 18 panels of 4 or 5 scientists selected for their knowledge of the field. A panel on enzymes represents one of 6 under the chemistry section. On viruses, 1 of 5 under the biology section, and so forth. The panel deliberations are transmitted to the section, and through the section chairman to the executive committee of which he is a member. Not infrequently, a single request involves several fields, and then is referred to other panels, often in different sections. The executive committee weighs these reports, as does the Committee on Growth. And the conclusions are then forwarded to the American Cancer Society as advice. The Committee on Growth includes 122 scientists. The executive committee is composed of the chairman of the sections representing physics, chemistry, biology, clinical investigation, chemotherapy, fellowships, and also the vice chairman and the chairman of the Committee on Growth. The work of this group involves many thousands of hours annually. For which it should be emphasized, they receive no compensation aside from reimbursement for maintenance expense during active service.
Leonard, how does the government make decisions on how to support cancer research?
Dr. Huggins, our method of studying requests for cancer research grants is essentially like that which Dr. Winternitz has just described for the Committee on Growth. The 1937 Cancer Act provided an expert advisory council to the Public Health Service. On this are outside cancer specialists and research workers. Whenever they recommend grants, the Surgeon General may make them. However, if they recommend against them, he may not make them. The council has the advice of over 20 study sections, on which are 245 technical experts in the medical and biological sciences. Dr. Huggins, you are a well-known cancer research worker on the faculty of one of our major American universities, the University of Chicago. I'd like to hear you tell us how a university fits into the cancer research picture.
The universities, Dr. Sheely, provide the cancer research workers. The universities happen to be the most permanent of human institutions, where knowledge is stored, investigations are fostered, and the young and old alike are constantly indoctrinated with the paramount importance of truth and the lasting values of ideas. The universities try, more or less successfully, to teach people how to think and to inculcate them with eagerness to learn. Certainly, the young people are taught to develop a sense of values which differentiates between true and false, silk and shoddy. Cancer research cannot function without investigators, and it is the function of the universities and their departments of science to supply them. Cancer research is not a single field unto itself, but a melange of the biological and physical sciences. In promoting the good fortunes of departments of physics and chemistry, one is advancing indirectly cancer research in a very important way. There are many fields, therefore, which have to be supported in the universities. In brief, the universities must light the fire and provide the kindling for cancer research. No one can light a fire from the top. It can only be lit from below. The university men are not businessmen. In the past, they have worked on a very frugal basis. However, inevitably, some waste has been inevitable.
Well, Dr. Huggins, that word waste does frighten me. I have heard Dr. Kettering say that all research is a succession of failures, but what counts is if you succeed the final time. If the oil people were afraid of waste, there'd be no oil industry. One time they hit a gusher, several times they have a failure. One well may cost $20,000, and get oil, and another may cost $1 million and bring in nothing. But the oil people still keep on. After all, insulin was found at a cost of only $5,000. But there had been waste, or rather failure, prior to that particular essay. Mendel worked on the laws of inheritance and probably died, thinking that his work had gone to waste. But later, it was taken up, and it is still of value today. I'd like to tell you how I became interested in this research matter. Some years ago, I read of an unusual cancer research project, which I felt was blazing a new trail. Through inquiry, I learned that more money could be used to advantage, and therefore, I sent the head of the project some funds. I was surprised to get a letter from this man telling how much this assistance would mean. It startled me to realize that an able man should have to be grateful to me for giving a few thousand dollars toward work when this work might well be the very work which would save my life or the life of a member of my family. As I began to look about and to think this matter over, I came to reason like this. Industry made large profits through research and at times achieved results which were near miracles. I wondered why I and other businessmen could be willing and capable of thinking 10 or 20 years ahead where business was concerned, yet we did not think 10 or 20 years ahead where our health was concerned. I felt that if I thought in terms of self alone, it was to my interest to help with cancer research. Or if I was a little less selfish and thought only of my immediate family, then it was still to my interest and in their interest that I helped as best I could in this work. And especially if I thought in terms of humanity, then I had to act. Not being a research man, the only way in which I could aid was and is to furnish some funds to those capable of doing the job. Medical research work today is complicated and requires technical manpower and expensive equipment and buildings. This means that large sums of money are needed. No one of us may be able to furnish large sums, but if each will aid in proportion to his means, then our total effort can accomplish great things. More and more, I have come to feel that the doctor and his family, the businessman and his family, and the working man and his family have identical interests in medical research concerning this problem. Where illness is concerned, none of us is cured, as we may think, by the attending physician alone. This physician can only cure a patient if previously there has been gathered sufficient knowledge of the human body to permit proper diagnosis, and if, in addition, there exists a known and available remedy. In other words, the doctor cures by drawing from a reservoir of knowledge and materials. Let me give you an example. About 150 years ago, George Washington, aged about 67, and not merely our first president and greatly beloved, but also one of the richest men of the country, contracted a cold which developed into pneumonia. The physician was called in, and Washington's treatment consisted of about the following. He was bled heavily 4 times, given gargle of molasses, vinegar, and butter, and a blister of cantharide was placed on his throat. It's not surprising that his strength sank rapidly. Washington was doomed because his doctor could draw only on a reservoir of material and knowledge which was deficient. It is our research workers who will fill the various reservoirs of knowledge if we of business and if all of moderate means will give in proportion to our ability to give and if the government will also aid. We cannot count on the wealthy alone to carry the burden of medical research. All of us have a stake in medical research and especially in cancer research. Therefore, all of us should give according to our means. If a man become ill with cancer and perhaps must die an unpleasant death, and yet his money can buy him no cure, no matter how great his wealth, then to a certain extent, the man's money is counterfeit money. But if that money is counterfeit, is it not somewhat the fault of all of us if we see the miracles which research can perform and yet fail to help the workers in cancer research?
Now, the outlook for solution of the cancer problem in the university laboratory seems to be good. We're all very optimistic indeed. Progress is being made. We need supplies. We need funds. We need manpower. How does the future of cancer research look to you, Surgeon General Shealy?
Dr. Huggins, the future looks very, very rosy indeed. For one thing, we're beginning to plan our research better than we have in the past. We're beginning to look at the principal cause of death from cancer. For example, in the case of gastric cancer, We're now opening a large-scale attack on that one problem alone, and it is a big problem, too. We find our scientists meeting in Detroit in the very near future to again discuss the needs for cancer research and to report progress made in the recent past. We find actually a backlog of work to do and ideas, which I think Dr. Huggins will pay off.
Thank you, gentlemen. You have been listening to the University of Chicago Roundtable discuss cancer research today with Dr. Leonard Sheely, Surgeon General of the United States and Director of the National Cancer Institute, Dr. Milton C. Winternitz of the Department of Pathology and Director of the Institute of Human Relations, Yale University, Benjamin May, President of the Gulf Lumber Company, and Dr. Charles B. Huggins, Chairman of the Committee on Cancer and member of the Medical School of the University of Chicago as participants. This week's roundtable pamphlet includes the full text of today's discussion, special charts and pictures illustrating the facts on whom cancer strikes, types of cancer, and the number afflicted with cancer today, as well as a list of cancer symptoms which each person should watch for. You'll want to receive this pamphlet and to study the special supplementary materials on cancer research. Be sure to write for your copy and send 10 cents in coin with your order to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. For $3, you may subscribe to the pamphlet for a full year and receive 52 weekly issues. I'll repeat the address. The University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Next week, the Roundtable will present a special Easter program on Faith in Our Time. Today's Roundtable originated in the Mitchell Tower Studios of the University of Chicago. Enjoy life with Phil and Alice tonight on NBC.